Good evening, and welcome to 360 North's Writer Showcase, our literary program that highlights work by Alaskan writers. I'm your host, Scott Burton. Tonight, we'll hear three stories that take us from a bar stool at Darwin's in Anchorage to a wolf hunt outside the village of Selowik. We ponder the transient nature of our state's inhabitants and yearn to be loved. We start off our readings with an essay by Juneau-based writer Ray Freelander. Here, our narrator explores the emotional experience of having loved ones leave your community. Reading to the Alaskan Who Leaves, please welcome actor Christina Apathy.
It's that type of Sunday where rising out of bed comes slowly. And Jason and I find each other lounging, thinking out loud. It's August, right around 10 a.m. Summer is dwindling down, and a friend, a good friend, has just told me she is leaving Alaska for good. Alaska has been home for almost 5 years now, but I too have left for those few winter months of self-discovery, only to return ever more certain of my commitment to this place. And resting there, head raised up by two pillows, looking out the window, I begin to judge the ritual of leaving Alaska for good. I begin to think of this place as the boom and bust state of relationships, where if enough people left, those that remained would be considered walking ghost towns. For some, Alaska is the place you have to leave in order to love, which is indeed similar to the reason why some fishermen say their marriages have lasted as long as they have. When I had first arrived to Sitka, a new acquaintance explained to me that making friends in Alaska would be slow, that people would be wary to form anything substantial with me, since I could be leaving just as soon as I came, that making friends was synonymous with dating, and that no one wanted a broken heart. And here I was, 4 years later, resting in bed, not as someone with a broken heart, but as someone confused. And this is the moment when I turn to Jason and ask, "What do you call an Alaskan who leaves?" "Traitor," he instantly replies with a slight smile. "No, no, I was thinking more elastic. You know, because Alaskans tend to bounce back." A week earlier, we had met a born-again Alaskan returning to Juneau after a 6-year absence. Phoenix had been her surrogate home. "I haven't needed a jacket yet," she replied when asked about the reacclimation process, as if withstanding cold temperatures was an indicator of Alaska's presence in her blood. More often than leaving, we tend to define people by how long they've resided here. Informal rules are in place. You cannot say "from" if you were not born here or have family ties. Instead, the descriptor you use is "live." "I've lived here for X number of years." It is indeed rare to be from this place, and common to leave. And in a sense, departure is expected. Only by crossing the finish line of so many winters in a row can you claim yourself Alaskan. But what do you call an Alaskan who leaves, despite putting in their time to earn the title? The elders who need specific medical services not found here? The local youth desiring to see the world or receive an education that is only accredited out of state? Workforce families unable to find affordable housing or jobs? The snow chasers wanting a real winter? Or my friend, frustrated by not having already found love after being here for 3 years, feeling the call of another place, with other people who might have the heart she's looking for. Aside from Jason, I've asked the same question to other Juneau residents, only to hear similar responses, mainly, "They're quitters," "Stupid," and uniquely Eden reformists, where one discovers the ultimate paradise but still leaves. I call a good friend who I had met in Sitka and had watched leave for the promised land of Portland. When I share the nicknames others have suggested for her, she is, of course, offended. Alaska meant and still means a lot to her. It has changed the way she sees and relates to her Oregon environment. She is not a quitter. What leaving Alaska meant to her was confronting the sacrifices it took to live here. Alaska is expensive. It is dark in the winter. It is far away from down south family. And in some aspects, it is limited in opportunity, like finding love or a job that fits your interests. As it turns out, Alaska means different things for different people. What about the bush communities, she asks over the phone, the rural towns? Having been born and raised in Alaska, what if leaving means bettering yourself, your children receiving an amazing education, or experiences that change their and your community's lives for good? For good. For the good of ending this question-answering quest, I had to come to terms with the fact that there would be no clever title for those that leave, that elastic might not be appropriate since not all do bounce back here, that to some, they might even still be called Alaskan and not traitor. But a thought did break through the numerous attempts of classifying those that leave, and I'd like to share it with you in the form of a poem titled To the Alaskan That Leaves. To the Alaskan that leaves, of course I will adopt your plants, rusted fishing gear, crab pots, cutlery and towels, power tools, craft and gardening supplies, boot dryers, and rain gear. Give life to the extra tufts you will no longer need, and consume the salmon left over in the freezer. To the Alaskan that leaves, you were worth it. Worth being my friend. Worth seeing what the mountains and ourselves were capable of. I hold no resentment, no doubts that you did not give it your all to stay. And do not take it personally. You will be missed. I believe this place, this Alaska you have come to know, will have changed your life forever. And so I wish this for you, although I think it will happen naturally. To the Alaskan that leaves, I wish for you to feel almost like a guest wherever it is you land next, that you remain courageous and respectful of your surroundings, and that is one of the many lessons we learn living here, that you do not settle for lazy convenience, but fight for the good, for the memorable experiences, that you go all the way with yourself and not be discouraged by bad weather or people, since you have all the gear, except the extra tufts, that is needed. To the Alaskan that leaves, as a guest, as my friend, when others catch you looking distant or nostalgic and ask you about it, I wish for you to talk about this place as if it is still home for you. Alaska does not worry if you come home late or not at all, but we'll leave the light on just in case you want to find your way back for good. As I will leave my light on for you too, for good.
Thank you, Christina Apathy, and I'd like to point out that the writer, Ray Friedlander, is here with us in the studio tonight. Could you stand up, please, Ray? Everyone say hi, Ray. Our next piece is written by Anchorage-based Stephen Bolin, a writer who is a Inupiaq and from Kotzebue. While his short story revolves around a wolf hunt, it examines the bond between two brothers on different life paths. Reading My Brother's Village, please welcome actor Jake Wade.
Our lives were meshed together by the blood we share and these faces we wear. My name is Tovruk Julius Manigal, but everyone calls me Tubby. I had an identical twin brother named Tuokpuk Ignatius Sozrolik, who went by Tuk. Our mother was May Sozrolik. Well, she died from consumption when we were 4 years old, and well, we didn't know who our father is. Apparently, he was a white man, which makes us half-breeds, half Inupiaq Eskimo and half Italian or French, I don't know. My brother and I were adopted and raised by two white teachers who came from Michigan in the early 90s, Theodore and Joan Manigal. Tuck went to live with our uncle, Jack Sozrolik, when we were 16, and he dropped out of the Davis-Ramus school. He didn't get along with our parents that well. And Mom taught high school biology at the Davis-Ramus school, and Dad taught high school and elementary English. Tuck and I were always really close. The only difference in our appearances were the giant scar on Tuck's brow, eyelid, and cheek, and the fact that he was a little bit darker skinned than I was. Tuck changed his last name back to our mother's when he was 14. He couldn't stand having a white last name. We're from the native village of Selwick, Alaska. The day of my brother's death was long and beautiful and horrifying. We were 18 and I was graduating as the valedictorian from the Davis-Ramus School. It was a Saturday and I'd woken up to Tuck jumping on me dressed in his hunting parka, you know, and riding gear. My parents had always welcomed Tuck into the house despite their several past quarrels. To them, he was still their son, and to me, he was my best friend. We were headed out hunting that day, so the early wake-up call was necessary. As Tuck wrestled me off the bed, I nearly gagged from the stench of R&R whiskey that clung to his clothes and escaped from behind his crooked grin and white tongue. He got off me and jokingly said, "Rise and shine, white boy." As I got dressed, Tuck wandered out of my room to his old one and waited. I knew Tuck regretted moving out. I knew he would look around at my stacks of books and the many basketball trophies in envy. I knew he would listen to the proper English that I spoke and the large vocabulary I would use, and he'd feel inadequate. I knew my brother would be subjected to love whenever he came over, leaving him with nothing but regret. He and our Uncle Jack lived in an old one-bedroom house next to the Rotman's grocery store across the West River Channel on the island. The house was my mother May's, but now it was Tuck and Jack's headquarters for their petty marijuana crack cocaine business. Dad had cooked us breakfast downstairs after letting Tuck in, so we ate once all my gear was packed. I remember how Tuck would always call Dad Theo whenever he was over, but for some reason, some strange reason, as we were about to take off on our snow goes that morning, Tuck shook his hand and said, "Thanks, Dad." I didn't ask Tuck why, I just let it be. My parents lived on the mainland, which is really just swampland, tundra, and lakes. It's on the west side of Selowik, where the village school, houses, apartment complexes, landfill, dump site, wind turbines, and an airstrip are located. There's one gravel road in Selawik that goes from the Davis-Ramis School to the Al Adams barge landing. The rest of the village is covered with boardwalks. Tuck and I had to ride up and over the Rainbow Bridge, which, because the ice in the West Channel had begun breaking up already, the bridge is so tall and arched, so steep that there are snow-go tracks bolted to the bridge floor in two long strips that travel the entire length so people can have traction when they're riding over it. It also is completely fenced on the sides and the top so that people won't jump to their deaths or hang themselves anymore. Yeah. Once over the rainbow, we rode down the boardwalk to McCoy's, which is mostly a hardware store, but they ran a small deli as well. We bought some food and drinks, oil, spark plugs, shells, and some Copenhagen fine cut for our trip. Tuck stole his spark plugs, which were BR10EYAs, because they're expensive, and that's the only kind that work on his Pro-X Polaris 800 that he ran. The BR9Es is what I bought, and they're pretty common and cheap. He just smiled at me as they fell into his jacket. After pretty Carrie McCoy rang me up and said goodbye to Tuck, we raced over to Uncle Jack's along the wide, thawing boardwalks to grab a few things. Uncle Jack had been passed out on the couch when we arrived, which was a good thing because he would have given me an awkward handshake and said, "Sup, Tubby Master," and repeatedly asked me how Joni was doing. I took a seat on my mother's old wooden sewing chair, and I observed each discouraging way the wood panel-walled house had fallen apart, while Tuck grabbed a couple of bags of drow, a gram or two of crack, and his .30-06 Remington rifle. One more stop would be necessary before we were able to finally get this trip underway. Tuck and I had left the island, and we rode over the eastern channel of the Selawik River on the flat bridge. Not much is on the east side, other than maybe a dozen houses, two of which were very interesting. One of the two was owned by Jim McCoy. Years ago, a DC airplane had crash-landed on the east side, and old Jim made good use of the remaining fuselage by building and attaching a house to it. Now, the other odd home belonged to Richie Pooney, and most of his small, torn-apart one-story house was floored with padding, and by padding I mean spring mattresses. Richie was in his late 20s, and he runs a very illegal village fight club. Teens and young adults gathered a few nights each week at Richie's, and they'd make bets on whoever was fighting that particular night. There were also a lot of drugs and alcohol that came through the house, which is the reason we were stopping by. As we pulled up to Richie's, he was waiting in his kinnasook. That's a front shed leading to the front door, smoking a cigarette. Tuck walked in yelling, "Suvat," which means "what's up," and gave Richie some cool handshake that, I don't know, you probably see in a movie shown on BET. Baggies and cash were exchanged while I sat outside on my Ski-Doo MX-600 and threw a dip in a chew. After Tuck was done dealing, we both fired up our rigs and took off. We stayed on the east side of the river as we raced out toward our Atata's, our grandfather's cabin. It was always hard to keep up with Tuck, but this day I wasn't about to get smoked. So he barely had beaten me to the trail leading to the Tata's place, where the tundra met the forest. We stopped there at the trailhead and let our machines cool down and smoke a cigarette. It was about noon, very warm out as we sat there. And we both got up and stood next to each other and began to piss, making two T's engraved side by side in the snow. Tuck chuckled and said, "Brothers till death." I laughed, and, well, then I flicked the stub of my cigarette at him, agreeing. "You freaking know it." Now, he pushed me over while I was trying to zip my jeans like a jerk. We must have sat there 45 minutes just BSing about the things going on in our lives. He filled me in on all the effed up things that were happening back in the Ville, how business was booming, how Uncle Jack was a lazy piece of crap, all the girls he was messing around with, and how he had actually been doing. And we talked about where I was thinking of going to school, how things have been at both of our homes, the girls I've messed around with, and how our lives could have been so much different if he hadn't moved to Jack's. I suggested that we should get going once I noticed the look on Tuck's face. It was the kind of look a person might get if they were to think about how wrong they've become. The eyebrows scrunch just a little, the jaw sticks out barely, ears pulled back a bit, he bites the bottom of his lip gently with that forlorn look in his eyes. He despises everything that is his life. Tuck took off right before I did. The trail's only wide enough for one machine, with the exception of a few spots where, of course, I tried to pass him, ripping through the dense forest where the trees were so close together that every branch of each one would overlap the other. We kept our eyes out for the wolves we were after. We made it to a small shack we called a Tata's camp in good time, and we went in to build a fire in the ancient black wood stove. The absent windows had been boarded up for as long as I could remember, so I bought a bit of lamp oil and lit the lantern we always had left there. I flung off my pack, and onto the rotting dinner table I took my .308 Winchester rifle off my chest and took off my parka. Tuck pretty much did the same. Then we cleaned our rifles and mounted our scopes on them. We kept our scopes in our packs so they'd be safe and not become damaged or lost during the ride. And we didn't stay long in the cabin. As soon as we felt ready, the both of us rode out to the hills behind our Atata's camp. We climbed up to the tallest and clearest hill on foot and began our search. We peered through our scopes all around us for a couple of hours, trying to spot some game. Tuck scoped out a humongous bull moose a couple of hundred yards away in a clearing, but we weren't trying to spend all day and night packing that moose back to the cabin. We called it a day after not seeing a single sign of any wolves for the 3 hours we were perched up there. We walked down to our rigs and headed back to camp. Once back, Tuck decided he was worn out and he had no intention of staying the night out there with me. So then I knew he just wanted to get back to Selawik and smoke weed with one of his girlfriends. So I said, "All right, white boy, let's frickin' dip out." He laughed and quickly replied, "Okay, Tuvi Master, try to keep up this time." I packed my things up quicker than he did and threw snow on the stove, turned out the lantern and started my rig and got on the trail first. Tuck was right behind me, and I wouldn't let him come close to passing me now I was in the lead. Then suddenly, right as we neared the open tundra, two gorgeous wolves, they jutted across the right of the trail to the left. Both of us sped up to them with our rifles cocked, locked, and ready to drop, but the large gray and black Arctic canines had already become part of the eerie forest. There was no chance we'd find them. Tuck kept looking back along the tree line as we drove slowly over the barren tundra. I'd only glance over at him in curiosity. Eventually, we made it back to the east side of Selawik, where we just happened to run into Carrie McCoy again. She stopped us with a frightened look upon her face and exclaimed, "Tuck, something's happening at your house." My brother immediately took off across the flat bridge. I was right behind him. We stopped abruptly about 50 yards down the boardwalk from Jack's. Over half the village was outside yelling at the six state troopers who had beaten and cuffed our Uncle Jack. I looked over at Tuck beside me. His eyes welled up with tears. He looked back at me and in a shaky voice he said, "Brother, I love you, but you gotta go home." I stared at that young man who was a mirror image of myself as if he were a dream. I couldn't move. I was paralyzed as I watched him take his rifle off his chest. I sat completely still in silence and watched Tuck shoot two of the state troopers outside our Mother May's home. It was a pandemonium. Everyone scattered and ran as three of the state troopers began firing back at Tuck, who was already to the riverbank. Even though it was breakup truck, Tuck attempted to water skip his snowgo across the eastern channel with his rifle slung over his left shoulder. Almost to the shoreline, Tuck flew off his rig once he was shot in the lower back and the left thigh. He crawled over the passing pieces of ice and swam through the freezing water to the shore, by which at that time the three state troopers were across the flat bridge yelling at Tuck, telling him to drop his weapon. I ran, screaming my brother's name. I had almost been across the flat bridge when Tuck rolled to his side and aimed at the troopers. Tuck fired one bullet, which grazed a trooper's arm before he was shot. He hit seven times in the chest and the stomach and the neck. I left my rifle across the river so the troopers didn't stop me when I ran past them down to the shore. I dropped a Tuck and I held him across my lap. I tried to find a pulse underneath all the blood. There wasn't. There wasn't one. But his eyes were open, and I swear he was looking at me. I grabbed Tuck's rifle and I threw it about 11 or so feet away so the troopers wouldn't shoot anymore. I could hear them yelling, but I wasn't paying them any mind. Tuck, he lay in my arms, lifeless, as I told him, "Brother, I love you too. It's time you go home." I noticed all I could hear was the river. I raised my head to find every single person in Selawik watching me as I cried and held my twin brother. My parents waited for me across the channel. My brother's body was taken from me after a short while, but I remained sitting there. People crowded around me and Tuck's blood. They were all talking, but I couldn't hear any of them. I stared at the passing pieces of ice on the water as I tried to comprehend the fact that Tuck was gone. Some friends of mine and some of Tuck's got me up and took me home. I took off all my clothes, cleaned myself up. Afterwards, I moved everything I possessed into Tuck's old room, which had been the door next to mine. School was canceled that Monday so everyone could attend Tuck's funeral, which was being held at the Friends Church on the island. The entire community had shown up. Everyone from the mainland crossed over the Rainbow Bridge pretty much at the same time that old bridge shook so much. I thought it was going to collapse. The service was nice. A lot of people knew my brother. Many people cared about Tuck, even if he never believed it. They did. We buried Tuokpuk Ignatius Osralik next to my mother, May. The village moved on with their lives, and I left as soon as I graduated. My brother may have strayed down the wrong path. He made many mistakes. He had murdered, stolen, dealt, hurt. But he's my brother. And I miss him.
Our next piece is by Anchorage-based writer Elise Knorr. It was recently published in a collection of LGBTQ short fiction and poetry by Alaskans titled Building Fires in the Snow. In this story, our narrator explores the malleability of truth. Reading Fact Checking, please welcome actor Donny Gott.
You're a long, sad book about love, she said. Or I said about myself. We were smoking inside Darwin's, back when you could still smoke inside, and eating the free popcorn and drinking the cheap beer. After the Rainier bottle cap puzzles ran out, we'd turn to a game called Which Book Are You? She was a bestseller I lost on the bus. She was a work in translation. She was the one I kept starting over. She picked up my wrist and held it. She was always doing that, tugging at me, staking her claims, but she had none, at least not technically. I was dating a man at the time, a truly good guy, and she had set us up. Let's try and see the tip book, she said next. I'll ask the waitress. No, I said. It's taking advantage. Don't you want to see what another woman's breasts look like? She asked. This was a test, or a flirtation, or both. I have to work early, I said. I'll call you for lunch. And so there were no tits that night. The truth is, I had loved her since we were 15 and met on the ski team. She was always warm. No matter what the temperature, she could sit beside me on the bus and heat me like a furnace. My job at the paper was to check the facts and edit the copy. In practice, this meant correcting commas for 8 hours a day. I didn't mind cleaning up after others. I didn't mind having no byline. It felt comforting to make a decision and immediately take action on it, even about something as small as a comma. The fact-changing began as a one-time affair. I still remember the headline, Moose Overrunning Kincaid Park. I'd gone back and forth on whether to add the word are. Moose are running over Kincaid Park. I didn't want to insert a clunky to-be verb, but as it was, it sounded like only one moose was overrunning the whole park. And that's when I got the idea. The article's lead read, "A female moose protecting her calf charged a skier Monday at Kincaid Park on the roller coaster trail." Just as easily as I would correct a comma, I changed calf to calves. Just like that, the moose had twins. And in that moment, reality changed entirely. And I was the one who had changed it. In fact, the closest I ever came to dying, I had thought of her. We were on a team-building trip, whitewater rafting near Hope. Six of us in a boat, plus the red-bearded guide in the back shouting paddle commands. She was right behind me, and she was 17, like me. 17 meant I had never once thought of death. We hurtled over an eddy and crashed down, bow first. Water rushed into the corner of the raft, and the front lip caved into the river, and then I couldn't breathe. Sucked out of the raft, and helmet smacked against the rock, and my very next thought was, did she see it? Did you see it happen? I was hoping to make her worry, to wring her hands and watch me drift downstream, struggling to turn onto my back, like the guide had instructed. Let the current take you. Don't struggle. I looked upstream for the raft and saw a yellow speck. Cold river trickled under my fingers, and I imagined the way water flowed over her skin in the shower, her fingers running through her soapy hair. She actually dyed her hair purple later in college down in Seattle and gained weight and lost it again, plus much more, all on a saltine cracker diet she adopted for various roles in various plays put on by the theater troupe. Through the window of the sandwich shop, we watched a line of tourists shuffle around the block, clutching cartoon maps and water bottles. You know, I skipped bingo for you, she said. She worked at an assisted living facility called Anchorage Manor. Her job was to plan the activities, crafts, spelling bees, and movie nights where they served mocktails. Those living with assistance were never allowed alcohol. Listen, I said, do you think the tit book is real? Specific rumors about the tit book varied depending on whom you asked. According to some, only women were allowed to access it, and only if they agreed to a Polaroid of their own breasts first. Like a sisterhood of the tits. Others had it that the exchange was a shot for a shot. And still others claimed that there was no tit book at all, or that the bartenders only showed the book to those they thought would be too drunk to remember it. Why don't you do a story on it and find out, she said. Isn't that the whole point of the paper, to uncover the truth? Yeah, right, I said. I'd never do that. What are you so afraid of? She asked. Her eyes locked on mine and made their point known. For years, we'd been doing this dance, testing each other, slowly building a case. About 60% of the time, I was sure she wanted me, but that wasn't enough to tell her. There was too much at stake. It was too great a gamble. A week or two after the moose, in an article about the salmon derby in Seward, I changed the weight of the prize salmon from 51.4 pounds to 51.9. I knew the winning fisherman wouldn't call in to the reporter and air half a pound in his favor. This was the art, getting away with it, of course, but more importantly, ensuring the fact change did not disrupt anything essential to the story's meaning. That, I decided, would be unethical. And I am a very ethical person. So, I never gave any misinformation or invented quotes. It was the small details I altered. And in this way, I felt like leaving my mark, like an artist's signature, like finding the artist's hand in a painting's tiny brush strokes. I started to love seeing copies of the paper around town in a way I had never before. A thrill went through me every time, knowing at least one of my secrets always lay inside. One year, I flew down to surprise her when she was a shark in the chorus of West Side Story. I was shocked at how thin she was, all golden eyes, hungry and hollowed out in her skull. She didn't even have a speaking part. All I wanted was to hold her shaky bones in my hands and feed her directly from my mouth. And I wanted to put her fingers into my mouth, too. And that's when I first realized that, like her, all I am is hunger and need. Sometimes she'd call me from the manor after she put the assisted to bed. We'd do crosswords over the phone together or watch Bewitched and fight over which dick we liked better. I'd cross out commas and listen to all the things she had to say. "It's depressing around here," she might mutter. "Isn't your job to keep them happy?" I'd ask. "There's only so much you can do," she'd say, "to make them remember who they are." That afternoon, I made my biggest fact change yet. The story was about a brown bear who'd been shot in Girdwood after breaking into a house. He had smelled pizza cooling on someone's kitchen counter and had smashed in a window to get it. The homeowner had shot him 3 times with a shotgun. My first thought was, what a stupid reason to die. I mean, for pizza, of all things. But then I felt embarrassed for the bear, and then I felt sorry for him. He was either so hungry he had to barge into someone's home, or so brave he didn't care. One was pitiable and the other admirable, and as I sat at my desk, oscillating between the two feelings, I realized that I couldn't tell the difference, and that the difference didn't matter. I was the Great Gatsby, and she was the Sound and the Fury. I was 100 years of solitude, and she was gone with the wind. I was surprised when she came back north after college. I thought she'd move to New York and star in Off-Off and then Off, and then Broadway productions. Singing and acting and dancing were all she'd ever cared about. Once I'd asked her how she could be so completely, so believably someone else, and she shrugged and said, "That's why they call it acting." And I knew then that she would ruin me all the way through. The only thing that could be done to restore the bear's dignity was to retell this one part of the story, how many shots it had taken to bring him down. In one quick moment, I blacked out 3 and I changed it to 6. And then I stood up quickly and carried the page down the hall to the copy chief for final proofing. The whole walk back to my desk, my hands shook and I was hot with fear and relief. I reached for the phone and as soon as I sat down, "It's me," I said. "Do you have a movie night tonight?" "Yeah, A League of Their Own," she said, "but I can skip." "Okay, let's do Darwin's at 9. "I've always loved what a wild woman you are," she said. By 10, we were silly drunk. By 11, she had cried once and put her hand on my knee once and interrupted me in the middle of a story to hug me because I was so funny and she loved me so much and she was so, so glad we were friends. As the night went on, tourists smelling like hotels and buses started crowding the small bar, knocking over beers with their elbows and pointing at locals indiscriminately. "Let's get out of here," she said, taking my hand, and we walked down 6th to the inlet. The ravens had all changed into their summer whites, and they were cawing so loud I could barely hear her when she said, "Tell me a secret." "What kind?" I asked. "You know all mine." "If I knew all your secrets," she said, "I wouldn't still hang around with you." I thought of the bear, dying with the taste of hot bread in his mouth. I thought of the way her chin tucked to her chest when she glided down a hill. I thought of myself in the ladies' room after her play, holding my head in my hands and breathing. "Tell yours first," I said, and the gulls cawed at the thumbprint moon, and we both felt lonely. "I don't think I've ever really loved," she said. "Ever been really loved." except by you. What? I asked, and a hole tore open in my stomach. You know? And she did. No, she said. Tell me. Well, it's true. She was sitting beside me, in the cool air, pumping out heat like a radiator. Across the bay, Susitna slept in the purple light, waiting in the water for her love to come back to life. Yes, she said, it is. And that's when she put her hand on top of mine, and my chest tightened and released all at once. And in that moment, I felt like she'd opened some kind of back door in my life I didn't know was there. I was 17 again, 17 still, and I would never, never die. She kissed my hand, and I couldn't believe it. She looked in my eyes, and I couldn't believe it. She leaned in, and my heart was drowning itself. We talked for hours, long after the sun finished setting, making plans, telling our stories, laughing about how long it had taken. I felt like I was at the first act of my own wedding. She held my hand, and she traced my lifeline. She found herself in all of my futures. Once on the trail, her boot had unclipped from her ski, and frozen, it wouldn't snap back in again. I stopped and I walked through the pines the rest of the way with her, our poles and skis propped across our shoulders. We were still half a mile out when two huge snow-covered dogs came sprinting down the path toward us. Their harnesses jingled and their tongues lolled giddy. Hey, she shouted, just where do you think you're going? The dogs stopped immediately, looked at one another for a moment, and then turned around and ran back the way they'd come. Ugh. Everything is so urgent when you're in love, she'd said. She took it all back the next morning, of course. I had run all the way home and barely slept. At 6, I got out of bed, put on my best shirt, and I cooked a big breakfast of waffle and eggs. I made a smoothie. I drank it too fast, imagining and imagining what could possibly happen next. I had never been happier. I was washing the dishes when she called. My heart hummed like an engine. Hello? Hi. It's me. Listen, we need to talk about last night. Okay? I wasn't feeling well, and I had taken a lot of cough syrup and Tylenol PM. I don't remember exactly what I told you, but whatever it was, I didn't mean it. The way she'd said it, the complete honesty of her lie, it felt like a new silver fish just pulled from a foreign river, glittering cold and alive. Like these were the first words ever spoken in time. They were so pure and beautiful in their devastation, and I didn't even try to fight it. Are you sure? Was all I asked. Yes. It's true. The tit book is real. Then it is full now of breasts that might be dead. It might be bio waste. It might be full of milk. This is why I'm afraid of it. The permanence of a photo is not what's troubling, but the impermanence of flesh. All those women and their lives, their possible delicate lives. I stopped changing facts after the bear. But years later, I woke in the night thinking, of course, I'm not the only one. Perhaps the homeowner changed the facts, that perhaps the state trooper who salvaged the skull and pelt did, that perhaps enough facts have been changed or could be changed to alter the bear's fate entirely. Perhaps he is on this very day eating a king salmon on the bank of a cool, fast stream. After I hung up the phone, this is what I did. I sat completely still and listened to the stillness. I listened to her words in my head, and to the clock's second hand, and to the trucks rattling down the highway, and to a dog standing on top of his doghouse barking. The answer, it finally dawned on me, was to take action and go someplace else. But there was nothing to do, nowhere to go to survive that stillborn love. So I finished the dishes. I left in my good shirt. I walked under the brilliant, manic sun to the office. I let myself in with my key card, and I took the elevator up to the paper and crawled under the copy table to shake like the addict I was. If this was an earthquake, then I would hold on, surrounded by whatever I called facts.
That's all the time we have for this evening. Thank you to our writers, Ray Friedlander, Stephen Bolin, and Elise Knorr. And thank you to our actors, Christina Apathy, Donnie Gott, and Jake Wade. For more information on our writers and actors, to rewatch the program, or to learn how you can submit to Writer Showcase, please go to 360north.org. Good night.
Funding support for Arts at 360 programming comes from Northwind Architects.